Lecture 14, Medieval Jewish Philosophy, Maimonides.
We're now going to move into the Middle Ages, and we're going to be having two lectures, the first on Jewish philosophy and the second on Jewish mysticism. And what I'm going to be doing is introducing the towering figure of Jewish philosophy in the Middle Ages, Moses Maimonides, and comparing Maimonides on three different points to the school or the trend of Jewish mysticism in the Middle Ages. So not only will we get a taste of Jewish philosophy and Jewish mysticism, but we'll see how they compare on these three central issues. So we are beginning with Jewish philosophy. Jewish philosophy doesn't spring up in full form in the Middle Ages. You already have an inkling of the attempts to bring together philosophical ideas and the biblical tradition with a man by the name of Philo of Alexandria, who lived from 20 BCE to 40 CE. And Philo tries to read Judaism allegorically and philosophically while still maintaining allegiance to traditional rabbinic law. His writings are very influential for early Christianity, but they're almost entirely unknown to the Jewish community until the 19th century. So although Philo is of great interest to Jewish intellectual historians, as we talk about his influence on the Jewish community from the rabbinic period to the Middle Ages, it is nil. So we're not going to really look at Philo at all. Under the influence of Islam, which really spreads over much of the world in the 7th century, Jews began incorporating philosophical argumentation into their presentations of Judaism. Amongst the very earliest Jewish philosophers are Isaac Israeli and Saadia Gaon in the early part of the 10th century. And they write in relatively simple ways, not that reading them is simple, but in a simple way of reconciling philosophical ideas and religious truths. But the better philosophers understood that the way of bringing together philosophy and religion was indeed much more difficult than Saadia and, on the Islamic side, the Kalam, the religious philosophers of Islam, presented. And Moses Maimonides was the greatest, earliest philosopher in the Jewish tradition. He was debating, or he was contending, with an idea of God that was the inheritance of Aristotle. Aristotle, of course, is an ancient Greek philosopher, and Aristotle's understanding of God is one that is totally transcendent, not connected to the earth at all. God is unchanging, God is eternal, and God is uncaring. God doesn't care at all for the wishes, the ambitions, the dreams and desires of creation, of human beings in particular. And there were biblical verses and traditional religious notions that were in strong tension with Aristotelian thought. In the Bible, God is portrayed anthropomorphically as having the form of a human body. God's nostrils flare, God stretches out his hand, God sees. These kinds of anthropomorphisms were understood by the philosophical tradition as figurative readings. They should not be understood literally. God has no body. Indeed, Moses Maimonides spends the first part of his magnum opus, The Guide of the Perplexed, which he wrote in 1190, showing you how all of those anthropomorphic and anthropopathic, attributing feelings to God, all those terms in the Hebrew Bible should not be understood literally, but should be understood figuratively. And he indeed said that if you understand them literally, you are an idolater. He had very strong words of condemnation for that kind of literalist reading. There were others in the Jewish community who thought, you're not an idolater. In Maimonides, there are people who are bigger and better and smarter than you that have understood it literally, and they weren't idolaters. So that provides me with an opportunity to say that Jewish philosophy was widespread amongst the elites. But the elites are the elites. And not everybody was reading The Guide of the Perplexed. Indeed, Maimonides says in his introduction that if he's writing for 1 in 10,000, he will be satisfied to educate them and to bring them out of their perplexities as to how traditional philosophy understands the world and how traditional religion or Judaism understands the world. So Moses Maimonides, born in Cordova, Spain, in the southern part of Spain, in 1138, dies in Old Cairo, or Fashtat, Egypt, in 1204. His father was a religious judge in Cordova, and around the time Moses Maimonides was 10 years old, so in 1148, there was a change of regime in southern Spain, and a more tolerant version of Islam was replaced by a less tolerant version of Islam with the Almohad invasion of southern Spain. And at that point, the Maimonides family had to leave or face persecution. So they immediately left. There was a mother and a father and two brothers, Moses and David. And they first went to Fez, Morocco, and then they traveled all over northern Africa, eventually making it up to Palestine, and then settling, Moses Maimonides, settling outside of Cairo in this community called Fashtat. Now, Maimonides wasn't just a philosopher. He was also a physician, and he wrote many medical works. He was the doctor to the Egyptian sultan. He wrote a commentary on the Mishnah, which he completed by the age of 23, which is a fact that makes all graduate students quake in their chairs. In 1180, he wrote perhaps the easiest-to-read code of Jewish law, called the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah literally means the second Torah. And in his introduction, he writes, if you have the Torah and the Mishneh Torah, his book, those are all the Jewish books you need. Now go do something important with your time. Go study Aristotelian physics and metaphysics. Maimonides was not a particularly humble man, we learn from his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, nor was he successful, because generation after generation of Jewish student has taken the Mishneh Torah and tried to find its sources in the Talmud, in the Bible, and in previous legal literature, and so they haven't gone to Aristotle's physics and metaphysics, so in that goal Maimonides was unsuccessful. Maimonides writes the Mishneh Torah in 1180. 10 years later, in 1190, he writes the Guide of the Perplexed precisely to address the tensions between rabbinic Judaism and Aristotelian philosophy. The first of the three issues that we are going to take a look at is the debate around the creation of the world. Aristotle's position is clear. Aristotle maintains that the world is eternal. Eternal this way, eternal that way, eternal in the past, eternal in the future. It will never change. It has never come into being. It will never decay or corrupt. What we see is what we get. Now, that is not the position that the Hebrew Bible takes in Genesis, Genesis 1 in any case, or Plato. Plato, who came a generation before Aristotle, writes in the Timaeus that the demiurge, or the craftsman, takes elements that are already on the scene and fashions them into the world that we know. That is basically the description of creation that we get in Genesis 1. When the curtain goes up on the drama of creation, according to Genesis 1, there are all kinds of elements swirling around in a disorderly fashion. It's like a wasteland, this swirling, chaotic, howling wasteland on stage. And what God does is impose order on disorder, or impose harmony or a universe out of chaos, out of disorder. Now, the rabbis who inherited this biblical material, they were familiar with Aristotle, although Aristotle was never quoted by name in the Talmud or in any of rabbinic literature, but they didn't really understand the stakes involved. Maimonides understands the stakes involved in the description of the universe according to Aristotle versus the description of the universe even according to Plato in Genesis 1. And we'll see that Maimonides offers another understanding of creation altogether. So this is what Maimonides has to say in the Guide for the Perplexed. The belief in eternity, the way Aristotle sees it, That is the belief according to which the world exists in virtue of necessity, that no nature changes at all, and that the customary course of events cannot be modified with regard to anything, destroys the law in its principle, necessarily gives the lie to every miracle, and reduces to inanity all the hopes and threats that the law has held out. Wow. What Maimonides is saying is that if you believe in Aristotle, that everything happens by necessity, that the world is the way it is, and events on the terrestrial, in the terrestrial realm on Earth are governed by the supernal realms, by the movement of the stars, and there is no change in the order of nature, then that means miracles can't possibly ever happen. And if miracles can't possibly ever happen, then the rewards and the punishments that are offered in the Torah as ways of keeping the Israelites in line are a lie. So Maimonides understands that if you believe in eternity as the vision or the perspective of the way the world came into being, but the nature of reality, then the Torah must be false. So how does Maimonides handle this? First of all, he says that Aristotle didn't prove that the universe was eternal. He just asserted it. Therefore, we're free to disagree with what has not been conclusively proven. Maimonides says, look, if the scientists prove without a shadow of a doubt that the world is eternal, then we have to deal with it and face the consequences and take a cold bath as to what that means for our reality. But Aristotle didn't prove it. He just asserted it. Maimonides then argues that creation ex nihilo, in Hebrew, yesh me'ayin, something from nothing, should be accepted even without conclusive proof. Maimonides didn't think there was conclusive proof for creation out of nothing, but he said that we should accept it because it's possible and on the strength of prophecy. This is what the prophet Isaiah describes, and it is what at least one voice in the Talmudic tradition also understood to be the origins of the earth, that God created everything, poof, out of nothing. In other words, when the curtain goes up on the stage of creation, there's nothing on stage. And then God creates the disorder, swirling mass, and from that disordered swirling mass, God imposes order. So we really have three different models of creation. We have Aristotle, we have Plato and Genesis 1, right, that talk about pre-existent elements that God then imposes order on. And then this third model that Maimonides champions and becomes doctrine or Jewish doctrine in the Middle Ages is one of creatio ex nihilo, yesh me'ayin, creation out of nothing. And that allows God to do whatever God wants with the material that God had made. So if God wants to program in miracles, or if God wants to monkey around with creation, God can do so because God is the author of creation. And as the author, God can manipulate the text or creation as God sees fit. So it allows for creation ex nihilo, allows for miracles, and it allows for divine intervention in a way that Aristotelian necessity does not. Okay, let's take a look at the second issue here, which is prayer. Now, the God of Aristotle is both uninterested in human prayer and incapable of responding to human prayer. The God of the philosophers is not an interventionist deity. A personal relationship with such a God, therefore, is quite difficult. Why pray to such a God? What are you hoping to get out of the exercise? Now, Maimonides maintains, along with the rabbinic tradition, that prayer is a mitzvah. It's a commandment. But he also understands that prayer is a concession to human psychology. So here's how it works. Maimonides says in the Guide of the Perplexed that, quote, a sudden transition from one opposite to another is impossible, end quote. People can't go from understanding everything about the world this way to understanding everything about the world in a completely different way. They need time to adjust. He says this in the context of the Israelites being freed from slavery. In Egypt, they were steeped in idolatrous practices, those practices of the Egyptians. Those practices included animal sacrifices. So Maimonides says that when God brought the Israelites out of Egypt into the desert, the only way the Israelites knew to worship God was through these animal sacrifices. So as a gracious ruse, or as a noble lie, right, different translations of that Platonic idea of a noble lie, God allowed the Israelites to continue in this idolatrous practice of sacrificing animals, but to the right address. In other words, the only thing that changed was the address, so that way the Israelites could still feel like what they were doing was efficacious. What they were doing was still worshiping God, even though that's not the most noble, most authentic way of worshiping God, because God doesn't need it. Maimonides, like Aristotle, doesn't believe that God needs those animal sacrifices. Rather, we need to feel like we're doing something to communicate with God. And then what Maimonides does is he draws the comparison to prayer, which is of value only for the prayer, so that we can feel connected to God, just like the ancient Israelites maintained this noble lie or this gracious ruse of sacrificing animals to God like the idolatrous Egyptians. Does prayer have any impact on God? No. Do the animal sacrifices have any impact on God? No. But it's a concession to human psychology. Here, Maimonides is writing like a contemporary psychologist of religion or a sociologist of religion. And he's probably right in the sense that there is a kind of cognitive dissonance when one goes from worshiping one way to radically changing the mode of worship. So Maimonides understands that the animal sacrifices and prayer are a kind of gracious ruse. Okay, the last issue that we're going to look at is a huge genre of Jewish literature called Ta'amei HaMitzvot, or the reasons for the commandments. Everybody always asks me, so why is it that we are supposed to separate milk from meat? Well, there's only one true answer to that question, and that is, we don't know. The Bible doesn't say why we're supposed to separate milk from meat as part of the dietary codes of kashrut, or keeping kosher, but nevertheless, we know that we've got this commandment. Now, there have been all kinds of suggestions, including one by Maimonides, that is plausible about why we separate milk from meat, but as we learned in the very first lecture, the contemporary scholar Jack Sasson at Vanderbilt says the prohibition isn't about separating milk and meat at all. It's about separating fat and meat from the same animal. You shall not seethe a kid in its mother's fat. So all of these explanations for the commandment of separating milk and meat were actually providing an explanation for a commandment that doesn't exist, at least according to Professor Sasson. There are a few explanations within the Hebrew Bible as to why we should follow certain commandments. We should honor our mother and father. Why? So that we live long on the land. Do what they tell you to do, and then you'll have a long tenure on the land. That was the biblical version of immortality. Your name will be present in that place. In the rabbinic period, there were disputes amongst the rabbis as to whether the commandments had reasons, if they were to refine humanity, if they didn't have any reason at all, if it was just a decree of the king, or if they had reasons, but it's not our job to look into them, because you get into trouble when you think that you understand the reason for a commandment. The explanation that Maimonides liked the best was that all of the commandments were given to refine or purify humanity. The Hebrew is letzaref. It comes from the field of metallurgy. What you do to a metal, when you burn it down, you refine it or you purify the metal. Letzaref. We'll come back to that in the next lecture. The most important function of the commandments is to promote truth. Right? That's part of refining humanity. This is accomplished through inculcating true beliefs about God and the world. So, for instance, in Deuteronomy 6:4, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." There is a truth that is instilled by that verse, that there is only one God, that God is one divine unity. But Maimonides continues, there are also portions of the Hebrew Bible that were written in order to distance us from wrong pagan beliefs about God and the world. In Deuteronomy 11, for instance, it says that if we are obedient to God's will, we'll have rain in our season. But if we're disobedient to God's will, we will have drought, famine, disaster. In an agrarian society, rain equals prosperity, drought equals death. So what does Maimonides say about that? He says, look, if you look at what the other pagan religions were involved with that surrounded the ancient Israelites, they believed that if you worshipped these deities, these idols, that you would get rain in the season. So as a gracious ruse, God said, okay, same thing. You worship God, you follow God's will, you get rain in your season. But, and here's the zinger, if you worship them, if you fall back on the idolatrous practices of your surrounding pagan neighbors, not only will you not get rain immediately, but you'll be punished with drought. Ah, Maimonides doesn't believe this is true. It's not that you're going to be punished with drought, but the Torah included that warning as a way of distancing us from false or pagan beliefs, so that it would be an extra disincentive to falling back into the idolatrous ways that we had known as slaves in Egypt. Okay, so some things in the Bible are true, some things are false, but they're written with the purpose of distancing us from these pagan beliefs. Refining our intellect is the most important part of the commandments in the Torah for Maimonides. But a second reason for the commandments for Maimonides, which has to happen before, so it's chronologically before you can start intellectualizing about the correct nature of God in the world, is the attainment of physical safety and political security. Because without physical safety and political security, you can't enjoy the conditions that are necessary to pursue philosophical truths. So in this category, you've got commandments about abolishing wrongdoing among people. So no thievery, no murder, no adultery, things like that. You've also got commandments that promote noble moral qualities, such as honor your parents, love your neighbor as yourself. These ideas combine to flesh out what Maimonides understands the laws of the command, the reasons for the commandments, that they're designed to help us attain intellectual truths, and they're designed to promote political stability and physical safety. That's it. For Maimonides, it's all about us. The reasons for the commandments refine humanity. They have nothing to do with God. Why don't they have anything to do with God? Because in the Aristotelian Maimonidean worldview, God is autarkic. What does that mean? God is self-sufficient. God needs nothing. God really cares nothing about God's creation. Now, this idea is so antithetical to Judaism that Maimonides sometimes has to write in a way that is cryptic or esoteric. And so it's sometimes difficult to really understand what Maimonides is driving at, because he'll lie. He'll say two different things in different places of the Guide of the Perplexed. And what's more is that he tells you he's going to lie in his introduction. So since he tells you he's going to lie, you're looking for these lies all the way through the book. And scholars have historically disagreed about where Maimonides is lying and where Maimonides is telling the truth. So that starting already in the 13th century, there wasn't agreement amongst Jewish scholars as to what Maimonides meant. And indeed, those scholars that understood Maimonides to be as heretical in his thinking as some contemporary scholars, they banned the reading of Maimonides, and some even burned the Guide for the Perplexed. He was not a universally loved figure for his philosophical contributions. And even today in the traditional world, Maimonides is studied in the Orthodox yeshivas, the book that he wrote on the law code, the Mishneh Torah. You'll rarely find people studying his philosophical work, The Guide of the Perplexed. That has really been relegated to academic study. And so at the universities, people look at The Guide of the Perplexed, and they show how it has influenced St. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote several decades later in the 13th century, and how it synthesized Islamic thought and how it brought together certain elements of Kalam that Maimonides had a very low view of. And he also had a very low view of Sa'adia Gaon, for that matter, and the philosophers that came before him, and interpreted the rabbinic tradition in a new way with very creative readings, much in the spirit of how the rabbis offered new creative readings of the Torah. Maimonides offers new creative readings of the Bible and rabbinic literature in order to make them gel with certain tenets of Aristotelian philosophy. As we move into Jewish mysticism in the Middle Ages, we're going to take a look at these three aspects of creation, of prayer, and of the reason for the commandments, and see a very different kind of response to Maimonides. It is sometimes argued that Jewish philosophy, and Maimonides in particular, were responsible for the emergence of Jewish mysticism, because without that rationalization of the religion, Jewish mysticism wouldn't have swung its pendulum to the opposite extreme, as we will see in the next lecture, of looking at the world and God's relationship to the world as not primarily anthropocentric, having human beings in the middle. Remember, for Maimonides, everything that the Torah has to say is for the benefit of human beings. But what we find in Jewish mysticism, is this radically chutzpahdich, or audacious view, that the Torah is coming to teach us how we can best serve God's needs. Unlike Aristotle, for Jewish mysticism, God is totally dependent on human activity. And to be fair, it's not just human activity, but it's male Jewish mystics performing commandments with the right intention, with the right kavanah. So what we see as we make the shift from Jewish philosophy to Jewish mysticism is the shift from anthropocentrism, with human beings in the middle, that the Torah is to serve our interests and to refine humanity, to theocentrism, where God is the core and the reason behind which all Jewish ritual and ethical activity is commanded.